It's the morning show on the Ideas Network. I'm John Munson in for Kate Archer Kent. The laws that regulate alcohol in Wisconsin are complicated and confusing, partly because they've been filled with exceptions and protections for industries and businesses over the course of decades. That's created an often adversarial relationship between members of the alcohol lobby at the state capitol. In our continuing series, High Tolerance, Sean Johnson has this report on the politics of alcohol and how it's changing.
In 2011, Republican State Senator Alberta Darling introduced a sweeping proposal to rewrite beer distribution laws. 6 minutes later, she asked for a vote. It was during deliberations of the legislature's budget committee. Democratic Senator Bob Jauch stopped the roll call, still unsure of what was in the motion.
It is a little difficult when you have a nine-page document that didn't come up at any of the public hearings. But then it wouldn't be a budget without having something to do with liquor wholesalers or beer wholesalers. It is every budget.
It is Wisconsin.
The measure was being pushed by Wisconsin's beer distributors and Miller Coors. They said it would keep Anheuser-Busch from buying up beer distributors. Small brewers wanted that power for themselves, but they weren't there to protest. And after a few minutes of discussion, the measure passed on a bipartisan vote. Longtime alcohol regulator Roger Johnson saw votes like these over and over again during his nearly four decades at the Wisconsin Department of Revenue.
I think the thing that comes to mind is that old saying I would have is that, if we can't feather our own nest, let's fence in the competition. And that's kind of the way it was.
Before he retired in 2014, Johnson was known in the industry as the state's point person for explaining what the alcohol laws actually meant and how they'd be enforced. The constant fighting among different factions of the industry reminded Johnson of the All-Star Wrestling show he watched as a kid, when 25 wrestlers would enter the ring and only one would emerge.
We were, in my role, kind of the referee in that battle royal.
One of the heavy hitters in that battle is the state's distributor lobby, the businesses that deliver Wisconsin's beer, wine, and liquor. According to a review by the Wisconsin Democracy Campaign, distributors have given Wisconsin political candidates about $3.3 million over the past 20 years. Wisconsin Democracy Campaign Director Matt Rothschild says that puts them in the top 5% of all special interest donors.
They know how to play the power game. So if Democrats are in power, they're going to give more money to Democrats. If Republicans are in power, they're going to give more money to Republicans.
Another major player at the Capitol is the Tavern League of Wisconsin. Rhinelander Republican Assemblyman Rob Swearingen led the group before he was elected in 2012. He says the power of the Tavern League is in its 5,000 members.
Because every one of these lawmakers has a tavern in their backyard, or a supper club, or a reception hall, or somebody that's got a liquor license.
It used to be that when the Tavern League and the distributors teamed up, they'd usually get what they want. But that hasn't been the case recently. The two groups have been frustrated with inconsistent enforcement of liquor laws by the Department of Revenue since Roger Johnson left. They supported plans to step up enforcement by creating a so-called alcohol czar and by regulating wedding barns that allow unlicensed alcohol sales. But both efforts were blocked by a new coalition that included free market conservative groups like Americans for Prosperity and the craft beverage industry. Jeffrey Glazer is an attorney who represents craft brewers. He says that as they've spread all over the state, they've gained grassroots power too.
Because almost every single state representative and certainly every single state senator has a brewery in their district. And those breweries are very popular.
Isaac Shawaki, who started Octopi Brewing in Wanakee in 2014, says smaller businesses have come into their own since that 2011 budget.
You know, as brewers, we're small, we're scrappy, and we tended to be disorganized. I don't think we're disorganized anymore.
Some members of the alcohol industry downplay the conflict. They say brewers, distributors, and tavern owners can work together at the Capitol. But if they're passing fewer big bills these days, it could be because the battle royale over alcohol laws is no longer such a lopsided fight. Sean Johnson, Wisconsin Public Radio.
You can read more about this story and see the rest of our series, High Tolerance, at WPR.org/alcohol. It's the morning show on the Ideas Network. I'm John Munson in for Kate Archer Kent. Middlescence. Well, think of it as being adolescence, maybe without the pimples and with a bit more wisdom. But is it a real thing? What about the so-called midlife crisis? This morning, we take a look at the myths surrounding our middle years and try to separate fact from fiction. Are you in your middle years? How does that compare to your adolescence? Do you take issue with terms like midlife crisis? Why? What negative associations do you think the word middle carries? Did you go through a period of significant change and growth in your midlife? Would you categorize it as a crisis, or have you always been growing and learning and it just continued into those years? Do you think we overgeneralize generations and age groups? Tell us your story. Give us your thoughts at 800-642-1234, 800-642-1234, ideas@WPR.org. You can also tweet us at WPR Mornings. Susan Krauss-Whitborn is Professor Emerita of Psychology at the University of Massachusetts Amherst. She is the author of the Psychology Today blog Fulfillment at Any Age and has conducted research in the area of personality and aging. Susan, welcome to the Ideas Network.
Thank you, John. Nice to be here.
First of all, tell us about this new term, middlescence. What does it mean and why is it becoming popular?
It was coined as sort of an alternative to the quote-unquote midlife crisis, and I'm glad you raised that question about midlife crisis. But it's intended to normalize the experience of midlife and help people understand the changes they're going through. It does have a kind of connotation of a second adolescence and refers not only to whatever's going on in your life, psychologically, socially, et cetera, but also hormonally. And I think that's what the inspiration for the term came from.
Well, did we used to call this a second childhood? Have we always used midlife crisis?
Yes. I mean, second childhood comes up in a lot of different ways. I mean, you can even find it in Shakespeare talking about old age. And it's an unfortunate concept because development always moves forward. It doesn't go back. And even if you're going through a period of life where you're trying to have fun and relive your youth, so to speak, you still have bills to pay, you have a family, you have a job to go to. It's never going to be like childhood, even though in your fantasy it might be fun to feel that way for even temporarily.
So the term middlescence, is this a more positive way to say middle-aged or midlife crisis? And is the word middle problematic?
Yes. Okay. Everything there, if we unpack that, everything there is questionable. I think it was just a term, and the person who invented this term was on CBS This Morning, which is where I got the idea for writing my blog about this. And underneath the interview with her, it scrolled the Wonder Years. All right, so I thought that was interesting. But the middle, what is the middle? I mean, if you're 60 and you're saying you're in midlife, well, then you're a terrific optimist. Because you're going to live to 120.
Yeah.
So it's just used as a kind of a broad term. It covers an entire swath of life. In this case, the term was intended to refer to people 40 to 65. Now, again, the 65-year-olds are optimists, but it just doesn't make sense that you lump everybody together like that and say they're going through the exact same experience.
You know, when you said Wonder Years, I was thinking, yeah, I wonder where I put my glasses, my car keys, my phone. Yeah, there's a lot of wonder. A more common term or idea around middle age, we talked about this, mentioned it earlier, the midlife crisis, referring to a negative experience or time of turmoil in our middle years. I don't know, you buy a red sports car. What are people talking about here? What are they pointing to when they say this?
The red sports car. excuse to go out and be naughty leave everything behind and go, you know, the old image of running off to Santa Fe or, some sort of retreat in a hut. But the original idea wasn't bad. I think the idea that in your middle years, whatever that is, when you feel you're, okay, I've gone this far, you stop and wonder, question about where your life is going. Are you doing things the way you expected you would? I mean, there's nothing wrong with a period of a reevaluation of your priorities. You can do that on a not continuous basis, because there has to be some solidity, but you can do that every so often and make some adjustments, you know, tweak. But somehow the crisis caught on, because everybody likes disasters. We don't really like to be in one, but everyone's fascinated with disasters. So by calling it a crisis, it then attracted all this sort of hullabaloo and became concretized in our modern everyday parlance.
So maybe what we need to do is rebrand the middle years somehow, so that we eliminate the word crisis. We can call it a reevaluation or something.
I wouldn't even call it the middle years. Again, you don't know your middle until you're at the end, when you're dying, and that's going to be the last thing on your mind. But there's no need. I mean, there's no need to kind of throw generational labels onto things or decade labels onto things the way that we do. Development is continuous. Age, they say, is just a number. But if you let that number define you, however you do that, it's going to be limiting and not allow you to kind of live your life free to make your own choices and deal with problems as they arise.
Susan Krause-Whitmorn is an author and professor of psychology. Our conversation about middle age, or whatever we want to call it, will continue in a moment. You can join the conversation at 800-642-1234, ideas@WPR.org, or you can tweet us at WPR Mornings. What do you think? Do we need to rebrand those years between 40 and 65? Is there a better term we can use than middle-aged? Give us a call. Let us know. 800-642-1234. I'm John Munson, in for Kate Archer Kent. It's the morning show on the Ideas Network. It's the morning show on the Ideas Network. I'm John Munson, in for Kate Archer Kent. We're talking about so-called middle age with Susan Krause-Whitmorn, author and professor of psychology. Do you think we overgeneralize generations and age groups, or do you see distinct characteristics or experiences of people in those categories? Do you think the idea of a midlife crisis is overemphasized, or is it just an experience for the privileged? 800-642-1234 is the number to call to join the conversation. 800-642-1234. Send an email to ideas@WPR.org or tweet us at WPR Mornings. So why is it, Susan, that we are so attached to this idea of a midlife crisis? Why won't we let it go, even when science shows us there's very little to back it up?
Well, it's one of those ideas that just won't go away, because even as the adult developmental psychologists like myself and my colleagues write articles, do research, you know, write my blog based on research, every time we try to kind of smash it down a little bit, it's like a whack-a-mole, and it keeps coming back because someone else comes up with their own redefinition. So I think that's one of the reasons it's hard to give it up. But there's also, as I said earlier, and I write about in my blog, this fascination with the idea that it's kind of magical that you can go through this period and be transformed. And on your dullest of days, your most frustrating of days, when you let your mind wander to what else could you be doing, you kind of enjoy the fantasy. No, it's like Game of Thrones. Your way through.
Or for those of us who are actually in the senior citizen category, maybe we would use Walter Mitty as our metaphor.
Maybe.
So do we know how common this experience is for all types of people? How much privilege is there to the idea or experience of a midlife crisis?
All right. Again, you've hit the nail right on the head, John. It's a very privileged concept. It's also male privileged in that its origins came from highly select group of men who wanted to validate their own experiences. This was Daniel Levinson at Yale. And that was a case of extreme white privilege. The people who can afford that red sports car, they are living in a certain social class. And even the people who are able to kind of, people with a college education, we know, tend to be more likely to sort of, not always, but think philosophically. And then you have to be able to afford that. Whatever your social class or your education, you can't afford to get away and live out this fantasy that you're going to be left out.
A related concept to a midlife crisis is the idea of the U-shaped life satisfaction. First, break down what that means.
Yes. So several economists have been asking people around, millions of people all around the world, about their happiness levels. It was part of a larger attempt to kind of map the happiest country. You probably hear every year they'll say Finland is the happiest country, or Iceland. So when they done that, they actually had people's ages. And so they said, oh, well, we can see there's this dip in happiness levels. And that dip consists of this. They asked people, how happy are you on a scale of 1 to 10, or 0 to 10? So that's it. That's your number. That goes in. That gets thrown into the statistics along with your age. Now, the actual range of scores, when you look at the U looks very impressive, but when you look at the scale, it's something like 7.2 to 7.4. Maybe, something of that nature. Because there are millions of people providing that happiness rating, it looks significant, but the meaning of it is very tiny.
How much does our happiness dip during middle life? I mean, it's not hard to imagine, you notice that first gray hair. Maybe you notice that you've lost a step as an athlete, or you're starting to have some more aches and pains, that kind of thing. You notice your body is getting older, and you start maybe trying to recapture your youth. Is that what's going on here? How much does our happiness dip during middle life?
Okay, well, the answer is not very much. And the study that I cited in my most recent blog on this, do we really need a new term to tell midlifers how to feel? Okay, so that study was done by a Clark University psychologist in the field of adult development, and he found that people were pretty happy, but it depends how you ask the question. Okay, are you happy at this very moment? Maybe not. Are you satisfied with your life? Well, actually, yes. So it all depends on the way that question is worded. In my own research, I've looked at identity and what you talked about, you know, the first gray hair, some little aches and pains. Those are triggers for identity kind of reevaluation, perhaps. Not to everybody, but to some people. And you deal with this change, you deal with the next change. It's like a bunch of different thresholds that, you know, life throws at you, or that you have to walk over through life, not just middle years. Mm-hmm. So when these changes occur, you approach it, you work on it, eventually you integrate it into your sense of self, and you move on. The next thing happens. So every one of those little kind of assaults on your identity, you can cope with one at a time.
We often talk about generations as having characteristics or age groups sharing experiences, but is it irresponsible to generalize this broadly?
Absolutely, and we talk about millennials, and you know they're the latest victims of generation bashing, or generation bad mouthing, and I think that's so unfortunate. But the same thing happened with the Gen Xers, and of course, the much maligned baby boomers. But you cannot call everybody in a generation the same. And the study I just looked at on perfectionism in millennials, they were actually quite perfectionistic. But not everybody. And they're no more perfectionistic, maybe a tiny bit, than their predecessors. So there's so much individual variation, but if you lump everybody into a generational term, it's easier. You know, it's less work. And then you can lump them all into this category and deal with them the same way.
Well, and every generation, when they reach a certain age, thinks kids are taking the world right straight off the edge of the cliff. And yep. It's what I refer to as get off my lawnism.
Yes, absolutely. But that also, I think, is an exaggeration, because I think the majority of people, as much as they'd like to complain, they're not complaining about everybody. And they're also, it's just maybe a kind of a fun thing to do, sound like you're like everybody else, oh, we like to complain. But I think most people have faith in the coming generations. And that's a really important part of psychological development, is to feel that the generations coming after you will be able to carry on not destroy the world.
Yeah, the idea of struggling during middle life, having that midlife crisis, is well established in the culture. But yeah. Those outside the category of middle age project these ideas on that group. Do they? Is that something we just kind of made up?
I don't think most people really think about it that much. In reality, you'll hear somebody say, "Oh, I'm having my midlife crisis," and it's a joke. And that's really what it's come down to, is a very trivialized and ridiculous characterization of important life changes that do occur, but they don't occur in this cartoonish fashion.
So would you agree that we ought to just appreciate whatever stage of life we're in and move on?
Of course I do. I mean, that's what else can you do? You can mourn the past, but it's really not going to get you anywhere. You can learn from the past. You can enjoy delving into the past. Mm-hmm. But we need to keep moving along and looking at not just a future orientation, but pull all together your past, your present, your future into kind of one view of yourself is changing over time.
Yeah, yesterday is history, tomorrow a mystery, today is a gift. That's why we call it the present. Thank you for joining us, Susan. Appreciate your time this morning.
Thank you, John. I enjoyed it as well. Take care.
Susan Krause-Whitborn is Professor Emerita of Psychology at the University of Massachusetts Amherst. She is the author of the Psychology Today blog Fulfillment at Any Age, and has conducted research in the area of personality and aging. This is The Morning Show. I'm John Munson in for Kate Archer-Kent. You're listening to the Ideas Network.